Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are continuing our week-long series on the climate crisis. Your Call has joined Covering Climate Now. It's a global journalism initiative of 250 media outlets committed to bringing more coverage to the defining story of our time. Yesterday, we kicked off our series with climate scientist Michael Mann. The Guardian's David Smith joined us to talk about what Hurricane Dorian in the Bahamas reveals about the climate crisis and gross inequality. And you can find that at yourcallradio.org. On today's show, we are talking about air pollution. According to the World Health Organization, dirty air prematurely kills nearly 9 million people every year. That includes more than 100,000 people in the United States. Today, more than 40% of Americans breathe unhealthy levels of pollution, making it the single biggest environmental threat to health. In the United States, the air we breathe is much cleaner than it once was. But as the Trump administration continues to roll back dozens of environmental regulations, including the Clean Air Act of 1970, we are on a fast track of reversing progress and policies that actually protect us and the planet. In her new book, Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution, today's guest, journalist Beth Gardner, writes, quote, "While clean air feels like a birthright, it can disappear in a puff of smoke if the rules created to protect it and the enforcement that gives those rules teeth are unraveled." Beth Gardner is an American journalist based in London. Her work has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times and National Geographic. She previously spent 10 years as a reporter for the Associated Press. Her book, Choked, came out earlier this year. And for the book, Beth traveled the world to show how air pollution is impacting all of us, from here in the United States to Poland's coal heartland to India's gasping capital. And Beth joins us on Skype from London. Hi, Beth. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for writing this important book. Now, you grew up in New Jersey, but you moved to London as an adult. And in New Jersey, you say that you grew up next to the George Washington Bridge, which you called the traffic choke point. But moving to London was really a turning point for you.
Well, in terms of air pollution, yes. I lived in an apartment overlooking the George Washington Bridge until I was about five, and then we moved to sort of a leafier, more suburban area. I lived in New York City when I was in my 20s, and I moved to London just before I turned 30. London does have a very serious air pollution problem. It's really not just London. It's a European-wide problem, which in large part stems from Europe's fondness for diesel, which is a very dirty fuel. But the reason why I sort of, you know, set out in the preface to the book some of my own personal experience was not really because I think that my personal exposure to air pollution has been unique in any way, but just really to sort of show that, you know, we go where our lives take us, right? We follow our relationships and our jobs and our family commitments and whatever the reasons are why we move places. It's not usually about air pollution and what the quality of the air is, but in fact, the places that we end up living, you know, whether it's a choice of city or whether it's sort of where you're house or apartment is in relationship to a highway or, you know, some kind of a polluting power plant or factory, these things have consequences for your life. And in some ways, I think living in London is really how I came to this story. And it's how I started to understand it through my own experience here, not experience of air pollution, fortunately, in the sense of, you know, having had any health problems myself or in my family related to it, but just being aware that it's, you know, something that's really a problem here sort of got me wondering, you know, why it was so bad, why British and European air is worse than American air quality, and, you know, what it was like elsewhere and what it was doing in other countries. So I sort of started following that, those threads, I guess, around the world.
And in London, where you live, you write that you can smell the exhaust when you're out running errands or walking your daughter to school, clouds of it billowing into your faces.
Yeah.
You write that after just a few minutes on a busy road, you often have a mild headache.
Yeah, it's really horrible, actually. You know, not compared to India, not compared to China. It's a developed world context. So, you know, European and British air is a lot cleaner than places like India, which is, you know, exponentially worse. But nonetheless, I came here from New York, and it took me a long time to understand why London's air quality was so much worse than New York's. You know, both are obviously big cities with plenty of traffic and trucks and buses. And the way I sort of ended up thinking of it, and it took me a long time of reporting until I really kind of came to this understanding, for London and really for Europe as a whole, I think kind of the proximate cause, the immediate cause of the air quality problem here is diesel. Mm-hmm. Like I said, Europeans are fond of diesel in most parts of the world, including the U.S. Diesel tends to be a fuel that's like more for heavy vehicles and equipment, like trucks and buses and maybe construction equipment. But in Europe, it's all that plus private cars as well. You know, a half or more of private cars in many European countries are diesels. It's 1 or 2% in the States. But what I actually started to understand once I dug a little deeper is that I think the real root cause of Europe's air quality problem is not so much a specific choice of fuel, diesel over gasoline, but it's a real failure of enforcement. And I think we saw this most vividly when the Volkswagen cheating scandal broke 4 or 5 years ago. Actually, California regulators played a very important role in uncovering that cheating and abuse. But what it really demonstrated was that European regulators had failed to stop, and in fact, even now, years after the scandal was exposed, have still failed to stop this really very, very blatant cheating under which Volkswagen and in fact other diesel car manufacturers as well were producing cars that emitted not a little bit over the legal pollution limits, but 8, 10, 12 times the legally allowed amount of nitrogen dioxide onto roads. So, you know, you can blame the companies, Volkswagen and the other manufacturers, for that deception. And, you know, they ought to be blamed. And in the US and also now in Germany, they're being criminally charged. But you also have to ask how they got away with it. And I think this actually really is sort of heightened, you know, calls demonstrate to me a really powerful contrast between Europe and the U.S. And it's also sort of a cautionary tale for us now as Americans, as far as what is happening as the Trump administration not only, you know, unravels all these regulations, but also really undermines the EPA, because Europe's problem stems from a failure of enforcement. They have rules on paper, but there's no European equivalent of a sort of central, empowered, well-resourced enforcement agency like the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has been. Mm-hmm. And I think not having that is why they have such significant problems with air pollution. And, you know, I think it really sort of should prompt us to ask where we're heading now as you know, the Trump administration tries to eviscerate what has really been a very powerful and important, of course, imperfect agency in the U.S. for nearly 50 years now.
Right. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I have one more question for you about Europe and London. You interviewed Frank Kelly, who's the head of the Environmental Yes. Research Group at King's College. And he said the big elephant in the room is that there must be fewer cars, all told, maybe Yeah. half as many today. He said that means a fundamental rethinking of how Londoners get around. And I have a friend right now who's right outside of Vienna, and she said the buses here are so amazing. They're so clean. You know, we always hear about the train system in Europe and how it really puts to shame the train system in the United States, especially when we're talking about fast trains, which we don't have. And so a lot of us are under the impression that Europe has an amazing public transportation system. So are more people in Europe driving? Is car buyer numbers going up, or can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, Europeans drive much less than Americans do, but nonetheless, if there's still a lot of cars on the road. And for a city like London and for, you know, other cities, I think continental European cities are a little bit ahead of the UK in terms of public transportation. You know, London is a city with a pretty good public transportation network, but it's also a city with a lot of drivers. And, you know, I think the reason that Frank Kelly, who's one of the UK's, you know, really most preeminent health and air pollution scientists, said that is, you know, because I think when we talk about air pollution, you know, people tend to go very quickly to, you know, electric vehicles and, you know, clean driving and all of that. And those things are great. And, you know, electric cars, no doubt, will be and should be part of the solution for making transportation cleaner. But if you just change out every fossil fuel car, whether it's gas or diesel, for an electric car, you know, you still have a lot of problems. First of all, there's particulates that come from the tires and from the brakes that are actually pretty significant and fairly toxic. Obviously, you know, you're lessening the emissions when you get rid of the fuel and the exhaust emissions, but you still have a problem, and you still have, you know, obviously all the other negatives that come from cities that are focused on cars and on driving, which is, you know, issues of pedestrian safety, issues of quality of life, whether it's noise or you know, sort of neighborhoods being chopped up by roads. And I contrasted London actually with Berlin, which was a city that I went to write a chapter for the second half of the book, which is sort of a more positive look at, you know, solutions that are kind of being implemented. And Berlin is not a place with pristine air quality. You know, it still suffers from this diesel problem and other sort of, you know, pollution that drifts in from power plants and things like that. But it is a place that's really pushing pretty hard to try to, you know, give people alternatives to get them out of their cars. Berlin, anyway, because of its history, it was a divided city, was a place with lower car ownership than other German cities. And, you know, like you say, the real foundation of what you need to do to get people out of their cars comes from, you know, not necessarily the sort of high-tech, you know, car sharing or e-scooters or whatever, but from good old-fashioned public transportation. And they have fantastic, you know, subways and buses and everything in Berlin. And then on top of that, you know, they're layering other solutions like car sharing, like electric car sharing, e-bikes and all of this stuff. And it's also a place filled with bicycles, right? Not just e-bikes, but regular bicycles. A real culture of cycling in Berlin and other European cities. London's not quite as well set up for that, partly because the streets are narrower and they're really filled with cars. But, you know, to come back to that quote that you started your question with, you know, for clean air, and also if you're talking about climate solutions, you know, electric vehicles are great, but we also need to think about how we can have fewer vehicles and less driving altogether, right? More walking, more biking.
Today we are speaking with Beth Gardner, author of Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. And if you have any questions or comments for Beth, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What is the quality of the air like where you live? And if you've moved from a city to another city or a part of the country to a different part or maybe overseas, what changes did you notice? And if you have questions about what causes air pollution and public health, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's talk about public health. You have so much interesting information in your book about the science. A recent study published by the New England Journal of Medicine found that even the smallest levels of air pollution can be deadly. And it was so interesting to read in your book about how, you know, where air pollution is just massive. So pollution concentrations can be 2 or 3 times higher by a busy roadside than even 100 yards away. I found that really interesting. So for example, if you're building a new school, you know, one of the people that you interview in the book says, why would you build it next to a freeway?
Exactly. Yeah. Or if you're going out for a run, you know, or you're biking somewhere or you're walking somewhere, you know, it's really smart to think about, you know, choosing your route carefully. In London, you know, I try to, if I'm walking somewhere or I'm biking somewhere, think about a way that I can go that would keep me away from a really busy road, because there is a big difference between pollution concentrations oftentimes right next to a busy street, and even like one block over if you take a parallel road or cut through a park or something like that. So, you know, those are things we can do to protect ourselves. But really, air pollution is a problem that requires a policy response and a regulatory response to solve it. And like you say, the science is so strong, and it's, you know, very disturbing when you start to read it. The links between air pollution and ill health are very, very powerful, particularly when you're talking about these tiniest particles, which are the most dangerous and harmful. They're known as PM2.5. And levels of those particulates are very closely linked to, you know, as they go up, you see a rise in heart attacks and strokes and multiple kinds of cancer and dementia and birth defects and premature birth. And, you know, the list just goes on and on and on, including, you know, conditions like diabetes and obesity, even some mental illnesses now starting to be linked to increased rates of levels of air pollution, things that are less, you know, maybe intuitive than asthma or breathing problems. So this evidence is very powerful. It's only growing. And, you know, it really does put air pollution up there as one of the big killers. And it's something that we don't necessarily think about, I think, or perceive. But it's very powerful. It impacts the health and well-being and all of us. And as you said, even at pretty low levels, you know, there are impacts. And there's actually no level of particulates that has been shown to be safe. But the, I guess, sort of more positive way to look at that is that the more you can do and the more you can push air pollution down and lower the levels, the more lives you'll save, and the more people's health you'll spare and improve, you know, pretty much right away.
You start the book by writing about what happens when we breathe. And we breathe about 12 to 20 times a minute, maybe 20,000 times a day, millions of times a year. It's really amazing when you sit back and think about that. What actually happens when we breathe in air pollution?
Yeah. So, you know, air pollution, these tiny particles now are believed to be able to cross to the and penetrate very deep into your lung and cross over into your bloodstream through these air sacs known as the alveoli, which is how oxygen enters our bloodstream from the lungs. And they travel all around your body. And scientists are still trying to understand exactly sort of how they wreak their harm. But it's believed that there's a link between these pollutants and inflammation, low-level inflammation throughout your body. And inflammation now is something that scientists and medical researchers are really focused on as being sort of an underlying cause of or contributor to many different sorts of illnesses. So, you know, I think that that's what happens. And these pollutants can travel to, you know, they've been found in the brain, they've been found in the placentas of babies, of pregnant women. They've been found in the umbilical cord. They've been found, you know, in just about every organ. So, you know, what really shocked me the most when I started to understand the science of what pollution does to our bodies was kind of this huge variety of all the, not just that it affects us, you know, powerfully, but that it affects us in so many different ways. But actually, when I kind of really thought about it and, you know, how fundamental breathing and air is to our, you know, bodies and to our lives, it actually probably really shouldn't be surprising that pollution is linked to so many different kinds of illnesses, just like smoking, really.
Right. You write about a really interesting study conducted by Ed Avall. Thank you. Avall, who grew up breathing the foul air of the 1960s in Los Angeles. He remembers the hacking coughs that filled the playgrounds of his childhood. He said that when ozone blankets a city, asthmatics wheeze, emergency room visits spike, and even in healthy people, the lungs can grow inflamed and struggle to do their job. And so he connected with John Peters and Duncan Thomas, researchers at USC's medical school, who had many of the same questions that he had. And so they got together to conduct an amazing long-term study, and it began in the early 1990s. Can you tell us about this?
Sure. So this is called the Children's Health Study at the University of Southern California. And it's really one of the sort of landmark, most important studies in our understanding of air pollution. At the time that these scientists were getting started, back in the mid-late 1990s, the biggest pollutant and most dangerous pollutant that was really sort of its effects were well understood was ozone, which is sort of the smog that blankets cities when you have traffic pollutants and other pollutants that bake in the sun. They form ozone. It's an irritant, and it can cause coughing. It causes your eyes to redden and water. But the team was starting to wonder, we know that there's these immediate effects when people breathe air pollution. We can see that it makes them cough. It makes their eyes run. It was already understood that heart attacks could spike on a bad air pollution day, strokes, emergency room visits. But no one really knew at that time whether there were also long-term effects. So, if you sort of survived a bad pollution day, but you breathed pollution every day or over and over again for year after year, what would there be a cumulative effect? And they suspected that there might be, but they initiated this long-term study. And what they decided to do was to measure children's lung capacity. So they recruited thousands of children all across Southern California in elementary schools, middle schools, high schools. And they went in every year, year after year for decades, and had these kids breathe into a device called a spirometer, which measures the power of your lungs. And now lung capacity is a very important metric because the strength of your lungs is really linked pretty closely to your health. And if you have poor lung capacity, it's a very strong indicator for lots of different illnesses and indeed even for early death. And so what they found over 10, 15 years, as they measured these kids' lungs, was that children who lived in dirtier places had significantly worse lung capacity, lung development, than children who had grown up breathing clean air. And the other thing about lung capacity is that once your lungs stop growing when you're 18, 19, 20 years old, that's it. That's what you have for life. Mm. So the air that these kids were breathing as they grew up, if they were breathing polluted air, really was, wreaking harm and consequences that they would feel in terms of their health for a lifetime.
This is really amazing. You write that for every 100 children who grew up with the worst pollution, at least 6 would be burdened as a result with a lifelong health problem. Many more would have a lesser degree of impairment, maybe a smaller wound that would meaningfully, if less dramatically, drain their vigor too. And so the researchers said this was a major wake-up call. And Beth, I think what's so interesting about this, when we do shows about diseases like cancer, dementia, I mean, there are many, many, many reasons why these diseases happen, but we cannot point to one. And you write about that in the beginning of your book.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the difficulties around sort of understanding how powerful air pollution actually is. And it's part of why this study was so important. These scientists had to use very, very sophisticated mathematical and statistical techniques to sort of tease out this, really pretty powerful effect. It wasn't something that could easily be seen with the naked eye, but once they began studying it, it became apparent. When I was reporting this book, you travel around the world and you come across these numbers. Every country, has a number of what's the best estimate for the number of people who die prematurely there every year from air pollution. In the US, it's 100,000 estimated premature deaths. In the UK, it's 40,000. I think Europe-wide, it's something like 500,000. And those numbers are, they sound awful. But the thing is that you never really hear of someone dying from the effects of air pollution. Mm-hmm. It's not something that we can apprehend in that way, except for, in the most rare and serious cases. So it's affecting us. The science is very solid that those deaths are excess deaths that would not be happening if the air was cleaner. But you can never really say in an individual case, you know, who it is. If I have a heart attack tomorrow, no doctor would ever be able to say, oh, it's because, you know, she lived in London for 19 years and breathed air pollution. You know, maybe it's because I don't go to the gym enough or I eat too much junk food. You know, there's a confluence of factors. So I think that contributes to this invisibility, which is, I think, an important dynamic around air pollution. And I think it's also an important political challenge, you know, when it comes to taking the steps to reduce air pollution, because just as we don't see the harm, we don't see the benefit. The benefit is very real, you know, literally people's lives are saved, but you'll never know that you didn't lose someone you loved because the air is cleaner than it would have been if this regulation that you probably don't even know about had been enacted. So, you know, it's almost like you don't know what it's doing to you, and then you don't sort of credit it when it's gone. And I think that creates a political challenge because, of course, the companies, the polluting companies who will have to pay the cost of cleaning up under these kinds of regulations, you know, they do know the cost, but we as the wider public don't know the benefit.
Right. As one Los Angeles environmentalist told you, you see one person run over in the street and you'll never forget it, but thousands dying from the effects of dirty air will never even faze you.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's very true. You know, I have covered a really powerful case in here in London of a mother who was trying to sort of, I guess, overcome this dynamic by putting a face on air pollution and its impact. She lost her daughter. The little girl's name was Ella Kissy Deborah. She died back in 2013. She was 9 years old. She had very, very severe asthma. And they lived next to a very busy ring road, a really heavily trafficked road in London. And, you know, I think her mom understands that this notion of invisibility and that we don't perceive the cause and effect. And it just so happens that Ella's case looks like it may well have been one of those very rare and extreme cases where you can actually draw a link to the air pollution that someone breathed and between that and their death. In fact, a scientist went and looked at it and found that of her, the 30 hospitalizations that she had to go through in the last 2 or 3 years of her illness, I think 28 of them correlated with pollution spikes in her neighborhood. So her mom, Rosamond Adu Kissy Deborah, has now successfully pursued a court case that has gotten the inquest into Ella's death reopened. There's going to be a new investigation into exactly how she died and what killed her. And Rosamond wants to get air pollution written onto Ella's death certificate as having contributed to her death. Wow. And I think that if she succeeds, that will be a very powerful statement. I mean, we all know the sort of old cliche, right? That one face, one human story is so much more powerful than a number or a statistic. Mm. And I think that's what she's trying to do here.
Wow. Today, we're speaking with environmental journalist Beth Gardner about her new book, Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. Over 9 million people die prematurely every year because of air pollution. And after a break, we will talk about the high levels of pollution in San Joaquin Valley. It's actually the worst air in the United States. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio. Billy Bragg is the guest on, and he'll be talking about music and politics in the next hour on 1A, coming up right after Your Call here on KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our week-long series on the climate crisis by looking at the impacts of the crisis on our food supply. According to the UN, the entire food production system accounts for 37% of greenhouse gas emissions. Meat and dairy account for 14.5% of those emissions. So we'll talk about how land and water use is monitored for food production, regulations, the biggest emitters, and then how changing our diets might make a difference. Today, we are speaking with Beth Gardner, author of Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. Air pollution prematurely kills 9 million people a year. And before we talk about the San Joaquin Valley in California, let's take a call and a couple of emails. Let's go to Vrinda in Berkeley. Hi, Vrinda. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose, and hi, Beth. I have a question about non-particulate pollution, like the methane leak that made a lot of people sick. I forget how long ago. And things like Roundup being sprayed around. I don't know whether Roundup's particulate or not, but also the fumes from gasoline that aren't particulate. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think Roundup was a pesticide, so that's more of a chemical toxin, I guess. So there are a lot of other pollutants too besides particulate matter. Methane is one of them. Ozone, which I think we talked a little bit about earlier, is one of them. Nitrogen dioxide is also a big pollutant. And, you know, generally speaking, most of these things boil down to fossil fuels, although wood burning actually is also another big contributor of that's particulate matter. But you know, I think that's sort of where I found this story of air pollution linking in very closely with the story of climate change, because they both come down to fossil fuels, you know, whether you're talking about particles or carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide or nitrogen oxides. They're coming from burning of fossil fuels, whether it's gas or coal or it's diesel. And, you know, I think that what I came to understand as I researched this book is that those fuels are not just, you know, as we sort of all now well know, driving this crisis of climate change, but they're also making people sick right now. Mm-hmm. Methane is, you know, you talked about methane sickening people. It's also a very, very potent driver of climate change, much stronger than carbon dioxide in the air, actually, mm-hmm. in the atmosphere.
Well, thank you for the call, Vrinda. We have a couple emails. Scott says, I grew up in the countryside and never had any problems with dust. I now live in downtown San Francisco, and if I leave the window open for a day, my entire apartment is covered in this fine black dust. It's a constant battle, and I had to get an air filter system to keep the air clean. I have no idea what the dust is or where it comes from. I presume it's from buses and trucks, but I don't really know.
I mean, that sounds like soot, and I would agree it probably is from buses and trucks and maybe cars as well. You know, this is just sort of become part and parcel these days of living in a big city, or even living in a smaller place if you're near, you know, a highway or something like that. And I think we've sort of all come to just take it for granted, I guess, as a, you know, kind of inevitable byproduct of modern life and of getting around and getting from place to place. But, you know, it does really take a toll on us in terms of our health. And I don't think it has to be this way.
Thank you for the email, Scott. Lynn writes, what is your opinion on campfires? It seems ironic to get away from it all, only to end up choking on air pollution from campfires.
Yeah, it's really true. You know, and wood burning actually, it took me a long time in reporting this book to actually really start to understand how significant of a pollutant wood smoke was and to kind of take it seriously. And I'm not even talking about wildfires, which is a whole nother part of this story. Mm-hmm. But yeah, campfires or fire in your fireplace at home, or, you know, these sort of wood burning stoves, which are in many cases sort of marketed and sold as being climate friendly and environmentally friendly. Wood is actually a very, very significant source of particle pollution. And there's a lot of toxins and carcinogens in wood smoke too. And in a lot of American cities now, wood burning, home wood burning is a pretty contributes a pretty big chunk of overall pollution in the wintertime. So that's true of, you know, of campfires, too. I was in a campground in Northern California recently over this summer. And like, you know, every single campsite had a fire burning. I think we must have had like really wet logs or something because ours was awful. It was so smoky. I kept having to leave and walk away. But, you know, I didn't want to tell my friends to put the fire out. But now I understand, you know, how impactful it actually is. I think we tend to have, and I had this as well until I really started, you know, to learn about it, this idea that wood is sort of natural and, you know, it's so cozy to have a fire and it's, you know, certainly couldn't be, you know, pernicious in the way that a fuel like coal or something we would more easily imagine to be toxic. But it actually turns out that wood smoke is really pretty unhealthy too. So, you know, I share your concerns about the campfires.
Wow. You know, and Beth, you just reminded me there was a piece in the Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, a couple weeks ago called Wildfire Season Increases Risk of Bad Air in the Bay Area. So government officials are basically telling people around the Bay Area to plan for smoky orange skies and unbreathable air that can drive us indoors for days at a time. And when we had the fires last year, it was really unbelievable. I mean, it's shocking in so many ways. And, you know, when you think about it, again, environmental justice, I thought so much about people on the streets. You know, what were they doing? They had no choice but to breathe this stuff in on a regular basis. I mean, yeah, you can go in the library for a few hours at a time, but you also have to take care of business. And so you're outside a lot. So there's just so many layers to this.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that sort of disparate impact is a hugely important strand of the air pollution story, I think. And also the wildfires points right towards the interconnections with climate change, because, you know, as I'm sure your listeners will well understand, a big part of the reason why wildfires are becoming more frequent and more intense and why the season is growing longer is because of climate change. And it's, you know, sort of this feedback loop where it makes it harder and harder to maintain good air quality. But, you know, I think you're very right to highlight the environmental justice aspect there. And we know, you know, more broadly speaking, even beyond wildfires, that air pollution's effects are not felt equally. You know, it certainly is true that we all breathe the air. And if we live in a polluted city, you know, everyone who lives there is going to be affected by that. But it tends to be poorer people and it tends to be communities of color who are exposed to, you know, significantly higher levels of pollution than, you know, white and wealthier communities.
Right.
And I think that's, yeah.
And I think the air filters are, I mean, the really good air filters can be pretty expensive. You have to change the filter. I mean, there's a lot that goes into this.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, who's more likely to live next to a big highway or near, you know, a port facility where there's, you know, container ships spewing out lots of dirty exhaust and trucks rattling in at all hours? You know, we know that those sorts of things, the polluting facilities, factories, garbage transfer stations, are much more likely to be cited in communities of color, and that people who can't afford, you know, high rents are much more likely to live in more polluted neighborhoods. And, you know, I think that that's a way in which air pollution really sort of tracks these much bigger and broader, you know, fissures that are dividing our society now, whether it's, you know, racial divisions or whether it's economic inequality. Air pollution is sort of just, you know, highlighting all of those divisions and fractures that we are already well aware of.
Well, we have a caller on this point. Let's hear from Catherine in Oakland. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. Yes, this is Catherine calling from Oakland. We hear a lot in Oakland about the impact of the diesel trucks in West Oakland. But I wanted to point to the fact that throughout our city, we've had streets turned into what are virtually freeway ramps just to get onto the freeway. I live on the Harrison-Oakland corridor, which is a major feeder down to the freeway where people commute to San Francisco. And similarly, as the previous speaker, we get so much soot and stuff on our back porch all the time. And there's a certain hopelessness, I think, in this neighborhood. We tried to implement a very ambitious plan to redistribute the traffic to some of the other streets, and people's vested interest in keeping the traffic off their streets has prevented any kind of implementation of that. And I think the fact that we're right below the city of Piedmont, we get all these wealthier people going through our neighborhood to get onto the freeway is an issue here, too. Hmm. One other question I had, though, was the only thing we figure we can do is plant trees and try to get people to voluntarily follow the guidelines on the Spare the Air Day when you're not supposed to use, for instance, gas-powered equipment. All over this neighborhood, the gardeners are still using gas-powered equipment, even though in Piedmont, above us, they have been outlawed, apparently. So just getting people to observe some of the things they should be doing on Spare the Air Day would be helpful. The other issue I have is population. That's a whole other issue, probably for another day, but we just see as Oakland's population goes up, even at the smart corridor, emphasis on smart growth, it's not really working. We're seeing more and more traffic because the traffic transportation policies are not keeping up with the growth at all. So there's a huge impact. Just on our street, we've seen traffic since we moved in here many years ago go up by so many fold, I can't even tell you. So right. Anyway, that's my comment and questions. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for that. Any thoughts on her comments, Beth?
It sounds like a difficult situation, and I think it's common, because you can have all these rules about Spare the Air Day and gas-powered equipment and all of that, but rules need to be enforced, and it's hard as an individual and a community member to, enforce the rules. You need to have local officials or, state authorities in actually enforcing the rules so that they're respected on the ground. I think that has to be an important part of the equation. As far as population, I mean, of course, Bay Area's population has boomed, but I don't think traffic necessarily has to be an automatic consequence of that. I would say that's less to do with the number of people, and it's more to do with a failure to invest in and provide adequate public transportation and keep it growing so that people wouldn't have to be in their cars all the time.
Right. And I should just add the failure to regulate Uber and Lyft and just allow them to put as many cars as they want on the streets at any given time, tens of thousands a day in the Bay Area.
But yeah, so that's contributing to traffic too.
Yeah, that's a huge issue. So Beth, we have about 15 minutes left, and I wish we had more time. We'll have to bring you back because I really want to get into the chapters about Delhi and the San Joaquin Valley. And so we'll have to do just small sections around this. So the San Joaquin Valley, it's such a major agricultural area. So you write that the San Joaquin Valley has the worst air in the United States?
Yeah, well, it sort of depends. There's different rankings because there are different pollutants. The San Joaquin Valley cities are the worst for particulate matter. I think LA is still the worst for ozone, but they're all sort of bumping up against one another on those charts. And yeah, the San Joaquin Valley has a, really very significant problem. Cities like Fresno and Visalia and the, rural areas around them. Partly it's to do with the, heavy trucks that are barreling through all the time and, picking things up from all the agricultural facilities there. But in fact, agriculture itself is a major contributor to air pollution. Mm-hmm. This was something that, came as a surprise to me when I first learned it. That's not true just in the San Joaquin Valley, but it was a really good place to sort of see that up close. So this is to do with, these huge, the San Joaquin Valley and the Central Valley more broadly are really sort of the epicenter for this very, very industrialized approach to farming that is practiced now in the U.S. and increasingly in Europe and in parts of Asia as well. And, it's very damaging environmentally, and it's very damaging to people's health, particularly the people who, work on those kinds of facilities and those farms, but also people who live in the area. So, one thing about air pollution is that it's not just to do with what's directly emitted. There are a lot of chemical reactions that occur in the air between different pollutants that come from different sources. And we see that a lot with agriculture. There are things like ammonia and a type of pollutant called VOC, volatile organic compounds, that come off of the manure lagoons and the fertilizers and the pesticides and the even the fermenting feed, which is kept in these huge piles in the San Joaquin Valley under big tarps. And when the tarps are taken off, then the chemicals that have resulted from all that fermentation drift into the air, and they combine with other chemicals. And it's all ended up meaning a very high level of particle pollution in the San Joaquin Valley from, you know, what to me was a sort of unexpected source, agriculture.
Right. You met Tom France, who sounds like an amazing guy. He started a group called the Association of Irritated Residents, which is great.
He's a gadfly.
Great guy. We'd love to have him on the show. So in Kern County, he told you that every square mile is home to thousands of cows. They're wall to wall almost. There's a spot near his house that's within a 5 mile radius of 10 mega farms with a total of about 60,000 cattle, and nearly 500,000 people live nearby. And the smell can be so oppressive for people who live near the dairies. And then you have to think about the people who work in the dairies, mostly immigrants and you know, people of color, poor people. Can you talk just quickly, since we're almost out of time, just about how this contributes to air pollution? You also write, in addition to the agriculture, Kern County is the center of California's oil and gas industry, home to 3/4 of the state's fracking operations and conventional wells. So people who live there are really being hit in so many ways.
Yeah, it's true. There's a multiple impact. And the San Joaquin Valley was a very good place to see the way that air pollution has this sort of disparate impact, you know, across around socioeconomic inequality and across racial lines, because, you know, as I'm sure you know, it's a place with a very, very bifurcated economy, with a, you know, a pretty small number of like huge landowning families that control a lot of the these really big ag operations, and many, many, you know, very poor agricultural workers, oftentimes, you know, migrant pickers, many of them immigrants, undocumented sometimes, and not English speaking. And they are really suffering, you know, multiple impacts, because it's not just the air pollution, but it's also, you know, the pesticides that are sprayed in the fields, and the way that those are affecting people who work there. You know, there's runoff that affects the water. A lot of these towns have very poor water quality, real problems with contaminated water. And those things have a cumulative effect on you know, the human body. If you're exposed to all these pollutants in a lot of different forms, you know, it's going to they're going to interact and affect you. And the San Joaquin Valley is home to some of the most polluted and contaminated zip codes in the U.S.
Hmm. And we'll have to have you back, because I wanted to talk more about your conversation with John Capitman, who is a public health professor at Cal State Fresno. And he sits between the advocates and the Air Pollution Control District. He said, this is a very polarized place. Politically, it has an almost colonial structure. There's a very small, very affluent group of people who run the valley. And, you know, this is, for the most part, in our backyard. People from around the world get their food from the San Joaquin Valley. So it's really important to know what goes on there.
Yeah, and the San Joaquin Valley and John Capitman sort of gave me some insight into this, because he's a public health professor, and he's also a member of the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District Board. And there's a very, very hostile and sort of difficult, strained relationship there between the regulatory body, the Air Pollution Control District, and the sort of health and environmental advocates on the one hand, and the agricultural interests on the other hand. And it's been just a sort of ongoing clash. And what I heard from, you know, the environment and health advocates was that the big landowners and the big ag companies are just, you know, really all about maximizing profit, sort of regardless of what it costs. And John Kappeman, you know, what the cost is in terms of human health and on well-being. And John Kappeman was sort of talking to me about how he tries to mediate between those sides and listen to both and, you know, try to bring about some dialogue.
Hmm. And I wish we had more time, like I said, but the section on India was also just so fascinating and also just so sad, because India is home to 9 of the top 10 cities on the World Health Organization's list of the most polluted. And you write that 1.6 million Indians die every year because their government can't or won't stop the burning of plastics and other garbage, of diesel, of cow dung, of the cheapest coal. The country's air is just so catastrophically bad.
Yeah, it is. And the human impact of all of that is equally catastrophic. I mean, the numbers that you've just cited are, you know, horrific. And as a contrast with China, which is the other place that's sort of obviously really well known as an air pollution sort of problem spot, you know, China is actually taking some steps now and doing something about their air pollution problem. And they're starting to see some success. India, unfortunately, you know, there's not really too much sign of progress. And it seems to have so far been a very ineffectual response from the government. And I think it kind of comes back to, you know, the poverty of the country and problems with governance and sort of failures of infrastructure. Because, you know, you see these garbage fires burning everywhere in the street in Delhi, where people just, the garbage piles up and then someone lights it on fire. You know, you wouldn't have to do that if you lived in a place with regular garbage collection. You know, you wouldn't have to have these trucks barreling through the city at all hours if you had, you know, better highways to let them go around the city. There's so many things like that in India. So it really comes back to, I think, you know, failures of infrastructure and of governance that are really very deeply tied in with poverty and development.
Beth, as you said, you do have sections on solutions. What changes are you seeing that will clean the air?
Well, you know, really one of the most positive stories of progress that I told was in a chapter that I've devoted to the political history of the U.S. Clean Air Act. Mm-hmm. So I think as Americans, we're not really very used to, you know, thinking of ourselves as fit to be sort of held up as examples environmentally, especially nowadays. But actually, the Clean Air Act is an extraordinary and very consequential piece of legislation. And it has brought, you know, tremendous progress in and tremendous improvements in American air quality in almost 50 years since 1970 through, you know, sort of slow, steady march of regulation. It's been a very effective law. You know, unfortunately, what we're seeing now in Washington is an effort to unravel a lot of the regulations that have been promulgated under the Clean Air Act, an effort to, you know, attack and weaken the EPA. And also, I think most sort of radically and maybe most consequentially, there's been a real assault from the Trump administration on the science that undergirds the Clean Air Act. So, you know, it's a lot going on.
Yeah. Well, Beth, this is a great book. We would love to have you back to talk about what else you found on your travels. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
You too. Thank you. Beth Gardner is the author of Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.